I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today is a very special show. It's one of the Wandering Poets shows. I like to do these shows when poets are passing through El Paso. I like to get them in the studio and talk to them face to face because there's something really organic about a conversation that's face-to-face. Not that the phone interviews are bad, because we are able to talk to writers from all over the world, but the face-to-face is awesome. And we have a poet wandering through El Paso, Texas, Ciudad Juarez this weekend, and her name is Natalie Centers Sapico. We have had her on the show before. She's an amazing poet, and she is right here in the studio. So we're going to have a conversation about all her success as a poet and a poetry and what it's like to be a wandering poet. I imagine, Natalie, with all your successes and your poetry getting out there, that you travel a lot.
I do.
Before we get into our conversation, let me just read a bio for those people who may not remember who you are or who may not know you. Although, if you're reading poetry today, you should know you.
Is that right?
Natalie Centers Sapico earned her BA right here at the University of Texas at El Paso. I believe you were a creative writing major.
That's right.
And her MFA from the University of New Mexico. Her poems have appeared in Tin House, Indiana Review, Poetry Magazine, Gulf Coast, and The Believer, among other journals that have consistently rejected me. I had to put that in. No, they're great journals. They're great journals. Her first book, Virgin Cities, won the Pan American Joyce Osterwell Award for Poetry, the Great Lakes Colleges Association Prize, the Utah Book Award, and the National Association of Chicano Studies Book Awards. That's quite a bit. It's a beautiful book. It's called Virgin Cities, like I said, and the cities, at least on one narrative level, are the cities of El Paso and Juarez. And of course, there's other levels of cities going on, but it's a beautiful book. A fellow in Canto Mundo, and most recently, she won the very prestigious Ruth Lilly and Dorothy Sargent Rosenberg Poetry Fellowship from the Poetry Foundation. You know it's a fancy prize when it takes that long to say the name. Her second book, Lima Limon, is coming out in 2019 from Copper Canyon Press. And Natalie Centers Sapico, welcome home to El Paso, Juarez.
Thank you. It's so good to be here.
And you're only wandering for the weekend, right? And then you wander back to Albany?
To Vermont, to Bennington, Vermont.
Bennington, Vermont.
Yeah, I just started a job there.
Oh, wow.
At Bennington College.
And are you teaching creative writing?
I am, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, so I'm a professor now.
Wow, that is awesome.
Since August.
Wow, so you are on the tenure track.
I am.
Wow, that's absolutely great because, you know, when you're a poet and you get an MFA, you're not going to make your money off poetry, although you can make a lot of money off poetry, but not enough to live. And so having to be a professor is the best job in the world to have.
Yeah, I think so.
Are you enjoying it?
I'm really enjoying it, yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Well, let's start off, Natalie, talking a little bit about, we're going to go way back.
Okay.
How did poetry find you? Do you remember the moment or moments when poetry found you? How old were you? And tell us what you can.
Yeah. I mean, I think I grew up in a house where poetry or literature was just always around, just sort of hanging out. And I was never really also in a household where I was really forced to read, but it was always there,
right,
if that makes
any
sense. And for poems, I think for me, my earliest memories is that my dad used to really like to read Eliot sometimes after dinner.
Oh, no way.
And like out loud. And my siblings and I used to think it was such a drag because the poems were so long.
And did he make you listen?
Yes, he would make us listen. That he would make us do. And he had a very captive audience, a forced captive audience. And then I remember in middle school or something, we were reading Eliot and I was like, oh, this is actually like a real poet. This isn't just like somebody that he's making us read just to be a jerk.
Wow. You know, you said, and I know your dad, and he's not a jerk.
No.
That's for sure. But you made me think of two things when you said something about the poets always being around the house. And when you said that, I kind of pictured like the ghost of Byron and like the ghost of these poets, you know, like lingering in your hallways, and then you walk right through them and get inspired.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it was just always very daily. So that I think was probably my first real interest in poetry. And then once I started high school, I was actually very concerned, or I always felt like it was a very strange thing that I wasn't taught poetry in high school at all, mm-hmm. really. And the only poetry experiences I had in high school were that we would get a packet with a bunch of forms, mm-hmm. and then we were asked to, like, imitate a form, which was both interesting but also very difficult if you're not reading in that form.
Right.
But I always really liked it because they always sort of felt like puzzles to me. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of enjoyed that.
Oh, I like that. Forms, creating, you know, particular forms in a poem like a puzzle. Like, you figure it out. How do the pieces
how
fit?
Do the pieces
that's
fit.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So for me, I always really enjoyed playing with it.
Right.
Playing with language and kind of messing up and trying again for a better line. Right.
Play is an important word in poetry, isn't mm-hmm. it? I mean, you know, you think of the play in theory of the duende from, mm-hmm. you know, Lorca. But that whole idea of playing with language or bending sentences and, you know, the energy sparks out of one. And yeah, that's really a wonderful way to say it.
Yeah, I think for me, if you're going to be a poet, especially a poet, but any kind of writer, any genre, really, you have to be in love with play.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're not in love with kind of playing around and playing with revision and just sort of re-envisioning something over and over, I think it would be a very, like, miserable thing to be into. You have to really like that.
You know, that's a very quotable quote. You have to be in love with play. I totally agree with you. I think that's really important that one of the things that a writer, especially a writer that has, you know, been through MFA programs or graduate school and had a lot of books and a lot of learning, one of the things that I think a writer needs to be aware of is that they lose that playfulness and that innocence, and they become way too intellectual.
I agree with that, like 100%.
Could kill a poem. Too much intellect can kill a poem.
Completely. Yeah. That's how bad poems are made. I think anytime that you really go into a poem saying, like, this is what the poem is going to be about, I'm going to write about this today.
Right.
You've set yourself up for a bad writing day.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that really segues into something I've been wondering about. You finished your second book, and I assume, you know, writing poetry, even if it's on napkins as you're on an airplane on your way to El Paso, Texas. But what is your process? How does a poem find you, or how do you find a poem? And does your process now differ from when you first started out as a poet?
Yes. Okay, hold on. That was a lot of questions.
Yeah.
So let me try to answer that as best I can. So I think that when I first started writing, I didn't realize this, of course, but I was trying to establish really good writing habits in the sense that I was trying to set time aside and make writing valuable in my life. Like, that was really, really important to me and seemed like a very radical act. And it was,
right?
But I also, when I was in graduate school, had more time than I ever did to be doing that,
right?
I mean, I could block out like 4 hours in the morning just for reading and writing.
Oh, that's
and
beautiful.
That's what
wonderful. I love that.
Yeah, and that's like what I had. And then after my MFA, I had a rude awakening that I, you know, had to have a job that would probably not allow me that amount of time. And so I all of a sudden had to find different ways to make writing a practice in my life. And that involved taking advantage of any time that I had, whether or not it was the same time every day or not. Like, it couldn't be that romantic anymore.
You had to steal time instead of time being given to you on a daily basis.
Yes, I had to steal time. And which, you know, I think changed my writing a lot in many ways, because suddenly if I was in kind of a mode or a moment, if I had to stop and go do something for my job, I had to stop and go do something, which was really hard. And so with that being said, I think that really changed the way that I initially would come to a poem and how I kind of come to a poem now. So I think when I first started writing, and certainly a lot of the poems in the Verging Cities, I spent a lot of time looking at other people's work. I spent a lot of time kind of looking at even just like what are the shapes of poems that I'm interested in, and kind of approaching a poem from that aspect. And I think with Lima Limón, I was much more interested in what is most urgent and pressing for me right now. What feels absolutely suffocating to me right now. It comes from a much more what images are making me feel that way, and exploring those images. So different.
Right, right. And I'm talking to Natalie Center-Sapico, poet and thief of time, and we're talking... No, that's great, because when you have a lot of stuff, you do have to steal time. But fortunately, there are these moments, and I hope this moment is revisited, where you have a block of time in the morning to write. And that's a much different experience. I totally agree. I mean, how can you... the challenge of a poet or any writer to have that block of time and to use that block of time for creativity. And even if that creativity means, you know, pacing and thinking and playing with the cat, you do need that time. And a lot of times it's very difficult for people to have that much time without going crazy or without getting on their phone or without, you know, doing things that require their attention as opposed to taking a walk. I think taking a walk is a beautiful thing. But I'm getting too verbose here. What I'm trying to get at is, now that you have those blocks in the morning, tell us a little bit about not only the process, but also about your morning routines. Tell us about like a morning when you have time to create.
Yeah, I have a few rules for myself, which is
awesome.
Interesting. So now that I think about it, and one is that, so I get up in the morning and I start the coffee, and only until the coffee is made am I allowed to check my email. That's it.
Right. No, I totally understand that.
If there's something really urgent, I at least, you know, have to see it and reply but it has to happen in that block of time.
Absolutely.
And once the coffee is made, I only dedicate it to reading and writing.
Right. And you avoid email and social media during that time.
Yes. I don't go on. Right. But I know that for some people, it's really hard to kind of put those rules on yourself. For me, in many ways, I think because I didn't have that luxury for a while, it feels really good to even be able to set that rule for myself. Feels like, wow, like what a great thing.
You know what neuroscientists are telling us these days? They're rebuking that idea that multitasking, number one, is possible, and that multitasking is a value that one should try to achieve. There's even people who would put it on their CVs, you know, my strengths, multitasking. But they're showing that the brain can't really do several things at once, let alone two things at once. And I think that space that you have between coffee and, you know, whenever it is you have to go back to reality, is such a sacred space. It's such an important space that requires our complete consciousness. And to split up that consciousness, of course, can be detrimental to the poem. It could,
Absolutely. And I think that oftentimes, you know, you're not really listening to the true imaginative work that you have the potential of engaging with if you're constantly sort of on social media.
Right.
Engaging with other people and things that aren't the art, right?
Like
much of social media, I mean, it's beautiful for promotion. It's beautiful for a lot of things, for community in many ways.
Oh, yeah, you know, definitely. I am not a social media hater. I'm participating.
Yeah, but no, me too. But I think that sometimes the art really gets lost in there.
It's like a labyrinth. I love your poems because your poems start with this, you know, some beautiful combination of language, and it pulls us into these landscapes, and you never really know where you're going, and you don't really care because you want to ride the language. But it's like a labyrinth, and a labyrinth, you don't want to be interrupted in the middle of the poem you know, while you're creating it or while you're reading it, which is why I also think you should never read poetry on an iPad, you know, especially if you have those little messages coming up, you know, like, oh, there's an email, and then you disrupt the poem. But that moment of concentration, do you ever find yourself in that moment where you're just writing and you have that creative space and you encounter an image or an incantation or a rhythm and it just, you just say, where did that come from?
Yeah, and I think that's what great poems are made of, right? And you're always sort of looking for that moment when you do get there and you do get that kind of surge. I think that another thing, though, that I think is important to think about that I don't think is talked about enough is how sometimes that moment doesn't have to come at the beginning of a poem when you're writing, right? It doesn't have to come like, this is the first draft and I'm going to start with this image because it came to me and it's really beautiful and I can't get it out of my head. Sometimes, if you're really lucky, that happens. But I think a lot of the time, at least for me, I'm more interested in when does that happen, or when that happens when I'm in the middle of revising something, when I'm in the middle of looking at something that I'm sick of looking at, that all of a sudden I'm able to see in a new way, in a fresh way.
Yeah. Every time you re-enter the poem, if you're re-entering it imagination first, and you're re-entering it not, you know, like a child, you're walking into that landscape, you notice new things. And the revision process to me is the most, to use a word that I hope I don't have to explain, is the more spiritual part of writing. I mean, I think the first, you know, the first prayer is important, but to go back in there is, you know, when you start to, you know, play with the parts. Okay, let's talk a little bit about your revision process. You have your first draft. How long can you work on a poem?
Forever. No, I mean, I think that oftentimes when you're working on a poem, when you're revising it, at some point you also just need space from it.
Right.
So at some point there is a place where you just sort of let it go for a few months and you don't look at it.
Have you ever come across a poem that you wrote when you were a naive young poet and now and think, hey, that's not bad, I could revise this?
Oh, yeah. There's lots of things that I, of course, wish that I could in some ways revise or play with. But I also try not to go back too much because I think I try not to go back too much in the sense of literally looking at old work and trying to revise that work. If it's something where it's something like that I think about from the older work, I know that it's a theme or something that I need to revisit in a new way.
Right.
But I try not to go back and look at older stuff and keep it forward momentum.
But you keep the stuff anyway. You don't toss it out. You don't put it in the little trash bin.
The book? Or what do you mean?
Like, oh, no, you're talking about, you know, oh, I'm sorry, you're talking about things that are already public.
Yeah.
Oh, no, that's not what I meant.
Oh.
No, what I meant is you find documents in your computer that you've written like a long time ago.
Yeah,
and do you ever like
the
open
graveyard
up and say, hey, that's pretty
of,
good.
Of old
yes, that's
stuff.
Yes, I'm sorry, yeah, we're talking about two different things.
Yeah, the graveyard of old stuff can be great, but can also be a little wild. I don't know, I mean, sometimes I like the graveyard in the sense of if there's something again that I'm like, oh, I think I remember a line or something that I wrote. But I also really like the idea of memory with regards to poems. So sometimes I even try to rewrite what I think is in the graveyard.
Right.
Because I think that that's
I
also
love that
a way of thinking about revision.
Yeah, I love calling it a graveyard. And because, you know, I think every writer that has been writing in the digital age has these digital graveyards, and they're vast.
Yeah, they're vast.
You know, because if you think about before the digital age, you know, we would write things on notes here and there, and they would be so spread apart that they wouldn't be accessible. But now they're just so accessible. And that metaphor works also because you know, when we go to old cities, like, you know, we go to Paris or Buenos Aires or Mexico City, we want to walk through old graveyards. You know, there's something about it that I don't know, it's a great experience. And I going through our own work can be haunting.
Mm-hmm. It is, yeah. And like looking at older versions of yourself, too.
Absolutely. And communicating.
And of your craft.
Communicating with yourself.
Yeah, sometimes I'll look at older lines and be like, oh, I could really rewrite this in a way that is not so clunky as it was before.
Do you ever have conversations with yourself when you go to the graveyard? Like, oh, Natalie, what were you thinking?
I talk to myself all the time when I'm writing. That's why I can't write in coffee shop.
Oh, nice.
I can't. I look like a crazy lady.
Wow. Or you look like you're on a Bluetooth. You can get away
well,
with it.
Well, I do.
How long, this new book, Lima Limon, your first book, Virgin Cities, came out in what, 2015? 2015. Mm-hmm. This is your second book. Are all poems you've written after the Virgin Cities, or are there some, I mean, how did this book come about, Lima Limon, that's coming out in 2019?
Yeah, Lima Limon, so I got the Virgin Cities picked up in 2014, and I felt like it was sort of, I felt like I had nothing left in a weird way afterwards.
Really?
Yeah, I felt like I had the graveyards of things, but I didn't have anything concrete. And I also didn't want to rewrite the Virgin Cities. So I really wanted to kind of think of a new project. And so Lima Limon was written in like 4 years.
All new poems?
Pretty much. Except
nothing from the graveyard.
Well, no, things from the graveyard, but not like poems that were complete.
Right,
does that
right.
make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Nothing
An
that
arm,
was complete before.
From the
right, yeah. Nothing that was complete, like that was completed during the Virgin Cities right. that didn't make it in or things like that. Definitely the graveyard stuff, yes, that was sort of redone right. and reinterpreted, sure, but different. I think I also really wanted in that time frame to prove to myself in many ways that I was actually a writer.
Oh, I totally get it. Even if you had a beautiful first book like you have, you know, it could, you can think too much about it and say, well, can I, you know, am I really a writer? Am I still a phony? I think writers call themselves or think they're phonies for a long time. But then eventually, you know.
Maybe. Eventually. Yeah, maybe, is that true? Okay. But I feel like I really wanted to prove to myself that I could sit down and write something that felt different and that also felt like that was a book project.
Right.
Because I think, you know, a lot of the poems from the Virgin Cities are also things that I wrote in graduate school. And so a lot of it I was thinking of it more as like loose poems while, not really working on a book.
So that actually, I was wondering about that. And I was hoping I'd have time to ask you that question. Did you, at what point in Lima Limon and in Virgin Cities, did you see the book and know it was a book and not you're just writing poems that will ultimately come together?
For the Virgin Cities, I think it happened in the middle of my second year. I started really focusing it in on place.
Mm-hmm.
And I really focused my reading as well on place. You know, people talk about documentary poetics and kind of that conversation. And so I started wanting to really be in conversation with writers who were interested in place. And so that was really my goal for the Virgin Cities. And that's when it started to feel like a book for me, was when I started to think of the poems in that way. For Lima Limon, I think for me, it was the title poem, which was published in Tinderbox. And that poem opened up the entire world of the book for me.
That was early.
That poem was early. And it really helped me think of what I wanted to explore. And it was almost like there were all these tentacles in the title poem in Lima Limon. And then I just sort of thought of the other poems as parts of these different tentacles from that main poem. So different than the Virgin City.
Right, right. And this book is coming out with Copper Canyon Press. How did that come along? I mean, how did that come about? Copper Canyon Press, one of the most amazing poetry presses in the country, if not the most amazing. How did it come about? Did you submit it blind?
No, I was really lucky that Michael Wiegers, who's the editor there, reached out to me and said that he wanted to look at some poems.
Oh, good.
And so I sent them his way. And I think that, I'm pretty sure that was because of Dana Levin, who's a great poet and friend of mine, who also publishes with Copper Canyon, who kind of, I think, told him about me.
And are you working specifically with Michael on this?
Yeah, I worked specifically with Michael.
I bet that was a great experience. That man and poetry, I mean, he blows me away what he knows.
Yeah, no, it was a really amazing learning experience, especially for being a young poet. Being able to work with someone like that was really incredible because he's just such a great reader.
Yeah. We're talking about the publisher, editor at Copper Canyon Press. I'm talking to Natalie Center-Sapico, wandering poet, wandering through the Twin Cities this weekend. And so we grabbed her and asked her to come into the studio. And Natalie, your poetry and your career is going very well. I mean, you know, you are what many people would call a successful poet. But I'm wondering, do you struggle with that? Do you still struggle with, like, well, am I a successful poet? How are you handling all that?
I think for me, the biggest struggle that I think a lot of, I think it's a very contemporary struggle in many ways, this part of that. There's always, I think, imposter syndrome, as we were talking about. But I think that for me, it's always going to be a question of also really focusing in on the work. So I think it's really easy right now to get very caught up in a lot of the noise because social media is so noisy.
Right, right.
And not focus on just doing the really boring daily work, but having fun with that. Like that should be the thing that you're focusing on. Like that's what it's about. And so for me, I think I always just don't want to be, I always have this paranoia, like I don't want to be known as like a noisy poet online. Like I just want to be with the poems and reading. Like that's what I want to, I would rather be known that way. And so it always makes me nervous.
Yeah, you know, I follow you on Twitter and I remember you you did this post one time that somebody has been Googling Natalie Center-Sapico age because you look very young. You know, so I suppose a lot of people see you and they see how successful you are and they go, "What? How old is she?"
It's true. People ask me my age all the time. And I'm like, excuse me, you should not ask me my age. But yes, I'm in my 30s.
See, I would have guessed you were in your 20s. You look very young. And is that looking young and being successful, is that an advantage, do you think? Or does it have come with its headaches as well?
I think it comes with its headaches. I think that for one, I think that there's a lot of attention given to young poets that maybe I always like looking at older poets. So maybe that's just my own thing. But I do think sometimes it worries me that a lot of people are only reading books that come out in like the last 5 years.
Right.
And while I think that's really important if you're working on a book, especially if it's your first book, to get to know the scene, I do think that you should be reading more than just books that came out in the last 5 years.
Well, that's great advice from Natalie Center-Sapico. You know, and it reminds me of the wisdom of a fiction writing teacher, I won't say who it is, that says, yeah, don't just read contemporary fiction. Read the old stuff, too, because, you know, there's something to be learned. That's, you're a wise poet, Natalie Center-Sapico. And we're out of time, but I'd like, if you can, I encountered one of your poems from Lima Limon, the forthcoming book, online, and it's called For My Son Born in La Mariscala. I was wondering if you'd be willing to read that poem.
Sure. For my son born in La Mariscal, Ciudad Juarez, you bob and spit and bite at my breast. You are my private colony of sharp stones. I burn your umbilical cord to cinders. Come, meet the spirits. Before your birth, I thought you an eyeball bruised purple. I have no crib to leave you in, but a box of maicena and a blanket of my thick, dark hair. I have done many things to feed your body. Open-legged, dark-thumbed things. Things for the price of what I can endure in 30 minutes before breaking. I know I can't keep you, but even stillborn, I used the blood I gave you to wash my legs clean.
Wow, that is a heartbreakingly beautiful poem. And I'm looking forward to Lima Limon. Natalie Center-Sapico, author of The Verging Cities and the forthcoming book, Lima Limon. Natalie, thank you for wandering through El Paso and through the KTEP studios.
Anytime.
And of course, we'd like to thank, unfortunately, for the very last time, our producer, Lauren Terrazas. She's leaving us. Lauren, good luck. We love you. I'm Daniel Chacon. See you next week.